This is Steve Maxner. On the 26th of January, 2001, at approximately 10:45, I am joined by Ron Frankum and talking with Dr. John Bessler about his slide collection. We are in the interview room in the Special Collections Library, and Dr. Bessler is going to be giving descriptions of his slides from Vietnam. So why don't we go ahead and begin.
This is a view of the South China Sea from off the shore of Vietnam. As you see, there are multiple islands out in the sea, beautiful country. During the Vietnam conflict, the Daily Press in order to give a negative view of our experience in Vietnam, spoke how terrible it was with the humidity, the mosquitoes, the monsoons, and all. And actually, it's very much like Florida. So if you are not afflicted with having to make a political point, one must admit that Vietnam is a beautiful country, and
That was slide number 80 that you started with.
Well, there we go.
Yes, sir. Just a real quick question: when did you first arrive in Vietnam?
June of 1970.
Okay.
And I left 2 days before the end of August. We get the impression that the United States was the only country with combat troops in Vietnam. From what the Daily Press would stress at that time. But actually, there were 9 countries that actually contributed troops. And this is very sensitive. The list of the 9 flags in front of the 5th Special Forces Group headquarters. Now, all 9 of these countries had combat personnel of one sort or another. This is not counting those that had those countries, such as West Germany, that participated in a humanitarian way but without contact.
So you were assigned to the 5th Special Forces?
I was a Special Forces. I was a senior ranking Green Beret in country. At that time, we had about 3,500 SF people. Most of them, majority of them, were down in the south of the country, involved in the Phoenix program. This must be on a timer.
There we go. Now it's off.
Here's another view of the South China Sea.
Okay. This is slide
quite
number 2.
Beautiful. This is a street scene of a medium-sized village. This is a picture of a group of South Vietnamese Arvin soldiers, and I put them in there just to demonstrate their size and weight and height. They were comparable to an American high school girl, anywhere from 98 to 110 pounds, 5'4", yet we expected and we got very good soldiering from them.
Okay, this was slide number 4.
Okay.
Now, This was near your hospital where you worked? Or
no, this was just I moved a lot around the country.
Okay.
I covered all the way from way down through Saigon mm-hmm. and back and forth.
Okay.
My orders allowed me to be attached to any unit that I stopped at. And in my travels, I just saw this group forming up.
Okay.
This is slide number
five. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. It shows the fire base of one of the companies of the 101st Airborne Division. I think this is Fire Base Tomahawk. As you see, the bunkers along the side is where the American soldiers
live, but used as fortifications in attack. These fire bases were generally supplied by air, unless they were quite close to the home base of the unit.
Because the Viet Cong
could get at them in ambush.
Did you travel to bases like this frequently?
Yes.
Slide six.
And this is the first unit I was attached to. I think this is my third day in country. The 498th Medical Company Helicopter Ambulance. It was at Lane, L-A-N-E, Heliport, near Ansan in South Vietnam. The man at the right is a major who was in command of the company. He had 25 helicopters. I arrived at night and in the morning came down for breakfast, went in the mess hall and noticed a table or two filled with exceedingly young looking fellows. And when he came down, he introduced himself and I commented when I came in, I thought I was coming into a high school cafeteria. They looked so young. He had 52 pilots. He said, the average age is 19. Now, when you consider that he's a major, he had a couple of captains and four or five lieutenants, and the rest were warrant officers. You can imagine what the average age among the warrant officers must have been to give an overall average of age 19.
Mm-hmm.
This gentleman was on his second tour and mentioned to me that he had become interested in medicine as a result of this. He was a MSC officer, Medical Service Corps, and asked me if it was a reasonable goal. And because of his age and the fact that he hadn't majored in pre-med in college, I told him how to make it up and apply. When he was rotated back to the States, he did just that and is now a retired colonel orthopedic surgeon.
Wow. Slide number seven.
This is an example of what area coverage by the helicopters constituted. There were three systems of aeromedevac in Vietnam. The Army had two and the Marine Corps had one system. The Army invariably used dedicated aircraft. In other words, if they were air ambulances today, they were air ambulances throughout the tour. The crews were dedicated. They flew air ambulance, period. One system was to cover the whole area by quadrants. Anybody in that area, whether they were Americans, Australians, Arvin, or civilians, or enemy personnel who called for air ambulance, got the service. This little fellow in front under the blue sheet was gored by a buffalo. As you probably know, little children generally herd the buffalo. They ride on them. Well, somehow the buffalo got angry and gored him. And his companion, little fellow, ran off to a militia station, Arvin militia post that were scattered like police sentinel boxes all around, and told them what had happened. They telephoned the radio telephone operator for Dustoff. Dustoff gave the word to this Dustoff unit that went zooming out there, picked up the kid. Mm-hmm. Well, that was a Vietnamese person, so they were to take him to a South Vietnamese provincial hospital. And in the provincial hospitals, the system in Vietnam was that members of the family took care of the patients, providing most of the nursing and like services. And so if you didn't have members of the family taking care of you, you were in a tough situation, because they prepared meals for you, bathed you, took care of you. So there's his mother, his brother, and his grandmother. All four were taken to the province hospital. This is, at that time, it was popular to think of Americans in Vietnam as ugly Americans. And it's interesting in this regard that these Vietnam civilians were getting better air ambulance service in 1970 at this time than we get in the United States in the year 2001.
Mm-hmm. Did they show gratitude towards and...
Yeah, they were, yes. They were in a tough situation because in their hamlets, they were very much subject to Viet Cong intimidation and coercion, because at night the Viet Cong would sweep into areas that had been cleaned out during the day. When some of the Viet Cong soldiers who were lost interest in being fighting for the Viet Cong were either captured or gave up, many of them had been involuntarily drafted into the Viet Cong army from the little hamlets, and would defect to and surrender to Arvin forces. Those who were willing to join the Arvin forces were put into units called Kit Carson Scouts, and they were like Indian Scouts in American history. And we train them and familiarize themselves with the way the Arvin did it. And one of the things was to show them that if they were wounded, they would be evacuated, most likely by air. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways we did that was to use a hoist with a jungle penetrator. Well, there were about 25, 30 of them in this group, and this was my third day in country, and I didn't know any better. And none of them wanted to ride the hoist. And it looked like there wasn't going to be a demonstration, and I foolishly said, well, maybe if one of us rode the hoist, show them that it was all right. And so the couple of American soldiers were pleased that I made the suggestion and voted me as the guy to ride the hoist. So there they're putting me on the penetrator.
That was slide 8. This is slide 9.
And there I am going up. Now I discovered that the hoist can carry one American or two Vietnamese or two Koreans or three Vietnamese. It has three little seats on it. And there I'm being swung in the door. After this was done, we were back at base. Major Mayor said, that was pretty gutsy of you. And I said, well, I thought it was pretty safe. And he said, well, it is really. The cables are rated for 40 hoists. That's on average, or 20 hoists. Some will last as long as 40 hoists, and some break on the first hoist. So they were smart not to have told me.
Mm-hmm.
But as you notice, the door on the helicopter's back slid back. It's hardly ever closed. They simply flew around like open convertibles.
Now, while you were there, were there ever any incidents where the hoist didn't break?
No.
Okay. This is slide 11.
And this is we're sitting on the ground at a Korean regimental headquarters. The first Korean and the called the Capital Division, and the second Korean Division called the White Horse Division were in Vietnam as part of our allies. We provided the air ambulance service for not only Americans but the Vietnamese, as I mentioned, as well as the Koreans, Australians, and whoever else. When they went on a combat assault, we would then not only operate from our own base, but send a helicopter over and park it at their headquarters, which would save considerable time in responding to calls that they got from the field to their radio telephone operator system. And we'd go out and pick up their people. That fellow in the white T-shirt is a young Korean soldier, little teenager, who somehow was enamored with American soldiers. And he, as long as we were there several days, he just followed around like a puppy. Wouldn't get any closer than this and wouldn't say anything, but would just kind of follow around and watch. And I suppose he was kind of impressed, because in that group, we had one black, one Korean, and the rest Anglos. And he may never have seen a black, and was surprised to see that a fellow Korean was in the American Army.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that was kind of interesting.
Of course, the Koreans had a reputation for being very harsh disciplinarians of their soldiers. Did you ever witness anything regarding that?
On one occasion, we went in to pick up a North Korean, an NBA soldier, who had been captured alive during a Korean assault. What the NBA would do when they were attacked, they would fall back and leave a rear guard.
Mm-hmm.
And generally the rear guard was made up of sick or wounded NBA soldiers and left in place to fight to the bitter end. Well, this poor fellow had malaria and was in an acute phase and was so shaken with fever that he couldn't even operate the machine gun he was assigned to. So they managed to capture him. Well, when the main body of the or the other members of the NVA force realized one of theirs had been captured, they really concentrated their fire and counterattacked on the Koreans in order to either get him back or kill him,
mm-hmm.
so that he couldn't be interrogated. We flew in to pick him up because he was sick with malaria, and that's the way they called him in.
Mm-hmm.
And as we came settled down on top of the jungle canopy, we took a lot of enemy fire, so we had to get up about 10, 12,000 feet and hover around there until dusk when they couldn't see us well enough to hit us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went back down and settled into the as low as we could into the canopy and hoisted him up. And he just was a pathetic little figure. Raggedy trousers and raggedy shirt, and that's all he had. He was shaking like a leaf in the aircraft, high fever. And Henry Mayer said, well, we have to take him to the Korean headquarters because they captured him. He's their prisoner. But I sure hate to do that. And I was participant observer, so I was learning as much as I could by asking questions. And I said, why? Why would you be reluctant to do that? And he said, oh, because he'll be dead by morning. And he finished the sentence by saying, the Koreans have a habit of interrogating them to death. They push the interrogation stimulus, which is torture, to the point where the prisoner dies. Then they figure, well, we really extracted everything we could from him, because if he had anything that he didn't tell us, he was willing to die for. They were a tough bunch. Our kill ratio was at that time was 4-1, four of the enemy to one of our Americans. The Koreans used to have a kill ratio of about the same. The Americans viewed their position in Vietnam as guests of the host country of the Republic of Vietnam. And as guests, they fulfill the requirement that they notify the Republic of Vietnam government that they wanted to go on a combat assault, notify them in advance,
mm-hmm.
and the government would approve or disapprove. Even though we were using American troops and not using any of their troops, it was one of those things, look, it's our country, if you're going to go attacking in that hamlet in that direction, tell us about it beforehand. Well, the problem was, they figured there was about one out of every 10 members of those Arvin military and government were actually Viet Cong people in deep cover.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as you notified the South Vietnamese government that you wanted to go on a combat assault, it was only a matter of hours before the enemy knew that you were going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Koreans quickly learned that that's what was happening to them. So they figured, well, the Americans can be nice guests, but we're not going to be. We won't tell them. So they wouldn't tell them. And they'd go on a combat assault without notifying South Vietnamese government, with the result that their kill ratio jumped to 14 to 1, because the enemy hadn't been alerted to withdraw. The enemy was still in place and caught flat-footed. This is a group, I was at 5th Special Forces Group and was going out to one of their fire bases, actually, at Bam Mi Thuy, one of their posts at Bam Mi Thuy, a B detachment. And the guy in front, the big guy, is a thoracic surgeon who is surgeon to the 5th Special Forces Group. The guy behind him is a sergeant major to the 5th Special Forces Group. The guy on the right is a Medical Service Corps officer with that group. And the kid over here on the left is new in country, just finished his internship and special forces training, and was being taken to Bam Mi Thuy to be assigned to their B detachment there as the medical officer. Because even though the special forces fighters were mostly Montagnards, the Vietnamese government and the Montagnards were somewhat alienated, and even though the Montagnards were fighting the NVA and the Viet Cong under U.S. Leadership, the Arvin government would not provide them with any health care or any support. As you know better than I, the Montagnards is something like in the position of the Native Americans. And the Vietnamese, as a people, were Johnny-come-latelys many centuries ago, but displaced the native natives of the Vietnam area, Indochina area, pushed them in up into the mountains. They're a rather primitive people, so that there was that schism between the natives and the present Vietnamese. As a result, the Montagnards, when they would join our special forces detachments and do the fighting, were really fighting for the United States. They did not consider themselves as fighting for Vietnam.
Was it standard for all medical service personnel attached or assigned to special forces to go through the special forces qualification course?
Yes, the SF is entirely volunteer, and you have to go through the program. You have to volunteer to be a paratrooper and successfully complete that, and then volunteer to go on through the special forces training and successfully complete that. And even if you successfully complete it, not everyone is assigned to a special forces unit. Those who are judged as not quite of the highest caliber of training, you know, kind of like the D student, they were not assigned. They had special force training, but then were assigned to an infantry division or an airborne division, but no longer were part of special forces. The difference in size of the people there and Americans is shown here. This is the little special forces dispensary at Bam Mi Thuy. These are Montagnard folks, soldiers and their families, and the Montagnards went into battle with their families. So wherever you moved a Montagnard soldier, along came his family, wife, kids, sometimes his mother and mother-in-law, and so on. But there's our sergeant major, who admittedly was a kind of a big guy, 6'2", about talking to one of the SF medics in the dispensary, and that's an average-sized Montagnard yard woman, two women next to him, mm-hmm. about two-thirds as tall, mm-hmm. really small, fine-boned people.
That was slide 13. Sir, the picture that was up on the wall, would you go back up a second? Do you know who that is up there in the right-hand corner? In the beret?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Don't know.
Okay. I was also curious if you recall one of the controversial things about the Special Forces qualification course for medics is, of course, the one of the final exams is basically saving the life of an animal that's been wounded.
Yeah.
When you went through, do you recall what they used at that time? Was it dogs, or had they switched to goats?
Well, they this was at Bragg where had the school,
mm-hmm.
and that was, by the way, the most highly the Special Forces medic was ranked as the most highly trained.
Mm-hmm.
Enlisted person in the entire military. They had 52 weeks
mm-hmm.
of training in their school, and to my knowledge, they were using dogs,
mm-hmm.
but I did hear that they were using other animals,
mm-hmm.
including pigs,
yeah.
but they would anesthetize them. And then shoot them in the leg, and the medic would have to then repair the leg, put on splints. So these medics were sufficiently well trained, and I knew the medical officer who was head of that school, tried to recruit him to our medical school
mm-hmm.
as head of preventive medicine and community health, but. I have sciatica, so if I'll stand.
Okay. Oops. There you go.
He ran the school, and they were trained so that with a Special Forces A detachment, sometimes called an A team, if it were put out in enemy territory, it could be out there for a year or 18 months
mm-hmm.
without any resupply or help,
mm-hmm.
so that the medic would have to be in a position to take care of most of the illnesses and injuries. In fact, one of the controversial things that they taught them was acute appendicitis. They could not plan on having that person air evac'd out.
Right.
And these enlisted medics were not trained well enough to do abdominal or thoracic surgery.
Right.
So, for example, on acute appendicitis, their treatment was medical, heavy antibiotics
mm-hmm.
for a long period of time, so that the appendix, even if it ruptured, would be walled off, and the soldier could continue without being evacuated.
Mm-hmm. Slide 14.
This is the operating room at Bami Tui. Now the Montagnards were not authorized. We weren't authorized any of this equipment. Now the table of organization equipment. This was not part of the anticipated need. But if you see, look here, it's pretty fancy stuff. And so Special Forces gathered this stuff together to staff, to equip this little hospital in Bamituig. And they did it by begging and borrowing and trading. You know, if you take an AK-47 and go to a supply sergeant back in the rear, and who is not going to ever have a chance to go capture an AK-47 because he won't get that close to a living enemy, and ask him if he'd like to have an AK-47 to take back home as a souvenir. Mm-hmm. You bet. Well, let's trade. So this is what they trade for. He'd see that they got a load of stuff out the back door at night. And so all of this is begged and borrowed and traded for.
Mm-hmm.
All called field expediency. You read the field manual and say, well, this is the way it's going to work. Not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
That's a guide, but you have to adapt it to reality when you get out there.
Slide 15.
And this is the little this is the little ward. All of these beds acquired the same way, and those are patients, Montagnard patients.
17.
And this is the Special Forces 15. Camp,
mm-hmm.
One of the more newer ones and more elaborate. You notice all the foliage is not just defoliated, but actually chopped down right down to level of the dirt, so that they can't be blindsided by a sneak attack. So the attacks would generally be at night, under cover of darkness. And as you notice, it's on flat land. It's not up on the hill. But rather, it's a fortified camp out deep in enemy territory.
And on the left-hand side, is that over on the side a short airstrip? To the very far left, yes, there's the clearing with all the buildings, and then over there, further out, there seems to be
I'm not sure.
That's connected by roads to the camp.
They all had airstrips or helipads.
Right.
Frequently, short airstrips, and the Caribou twin-engined de Havilland Canadian aircraft that was a dandy for short landings and takeoff,
mm-hmm.
was used to resupply.
Slide 17.
You notice the layout of this camp. These long buildings along the periphery look like rectangular loaves of bread.
Mm-hmm.
They're partly underground. So if there is small arms fire coming zinging along just a foot or so above the ground, if you're prone inside those little buildings, going over your head, and they're made of heavy logs anyway. And then you notice the center with that high embankment,
mm-hmm.
and a little jeep road around it. Well, the first line of defense is out here by those rectangular buildings, and those rectangular buildings are where the Montagnard soldiers and their families lived. They lived on the firing line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it wasn't necessarily planned that way, I'm not sure, but if you really want to motivate a soldier to defend a camp, you put his home with his family on the firing line, and it's a real motivator,
mm-hmm.
you know. They're less likely to drop their gun and run away. Well, if they're pushed back from that, and of course, around it all is barbed wire, concertina wire, if they're pushed back, then they can go up onto that center island, and the enemy following them has to come up that high embankment,
mm-hmm.
which makes the enemy very vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
In the inside, you see those pits? Those are mortar pits. And in the center, there's an artillery piece. The Americans lived in the center. Special Forces team consisted, as I recall, 10 individuals, captain, a lieutenant, and 12 sergeants. In Special Forces, all the enlisted personnel are sergeants because of their technical training. They're cross-trained. For example, they're cross-trained as a COMO communication sergeant and a medic. Same person can do both jobs. Or a demolition expert and a machine gunner.
Mm-hmm.
Heavy weapons do both jobs. So that you can divide an A-team, an A-detachment, in half and send four of them with a lieutenant to one camp and four with a captain to another. The mission of SF is to train indigenous personnel to fight for their own freedom, not to do the fighting for them. In other words, if they want to live in a free country, they have to free the country themselves,
mm-hmm.
rather than us do it and hand it to them on a platter. And that was the system.
How many American personnel were stationed at that particular camp?
10. And the guy on the left is the captain. He's about 25 years old. The old part on the right is 50 years old.
And that's you?
That's me. That young fellow is the captain, had all of these troops under him, and he had about 500-600 Montagnard soldiers. So it was quite a command.
And you're carrying an AR-15 carbine, is that right?
16.
An M-16 carbine.
And I also carried a 32 caliber revolver. And I'll tell you about that. When I arrived the first day I was there, I was told that surgeon, MacV surgeon to all of the military forces in Vietnam, Army General,
mm-hmm.
with jump wings with two jump stars on it, the one World War II and one in Vietnam that he jumped. He too was a thoracic surgeon. His name was Thomas, last name. And he called me in and he said, "Now, I'll tell you right away, the last thing we need over here is another colonel. But I realize that you're here to do a research project. And I've been briefed on what the project is. And since it will mean that you will be going into places and situations where you can either be killed or captured, do you have any objection to carrying a weapon?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, some doctors do." And I said, "I don't." He said, "Well, I want you to at least carry a pistol." And when I, he said, "Pistol." He said, "Oh, I don't expect you to win the war with a pistol. But I don't want to hear you on Radio Hanoi. I don't want you captured alive. That's why you're carrying a pistol." So it was a little message: if you're going to be in a tight spot, be prepared to commit suicide. And I was in such a tight spot, and thought it through, and fortunately, in the nick of time, I was rescued so that I didn't have to pass the test. But I realized I was facing the moment of truth.
Mm-hmm. What were the circumstances surrounding that?
Well, I'll tell you, it's not on the slide, it's over lunch, so I'll tell you.
Okay. And out of curiosity, you mentioned that you were working on a special project, a research project. Could you just briefly describe that?
I went to Vietnam to do an operational analysis of Aeromedevac as the basis for translating lessons learned in Vietnam to civilian application.
Okay.
And that's why, again, I'll tell you at lunch how that sequence begins.
Slide 19.
Here are four young Montagnard soldiers. They were sitting around, fooling around the Jeep, acting like high schoolers, until they saw me bring up the camera. Then they sobered up and stood there ready to take their picture. Their wives and children, on the other hand, were very camera shy. And I was told the reason for that is they felt that if you take a picture of them, you take a bit of them away. That the only way you get a picture is by having taken some of their body. So I didn't get pictures of them because even though I was around those longhouses, they're called longhouses, as soon as I'd raise the camera, as soon as they'd see the camera, they'd scurry in the house.
Mm-hmm. Slide 20.
This is Pleiku, the major city in the highland that was in the path of most of the invasion route from Cambodia and Laos and the Ho Chi Minh Trail. This is, even though this is a major city, you see the streets are still, it's quite primitive, dirt streets. It has to be remembered that the Vietnamese were at war from the beginning of World War II, when the Japanese invaded Southeast Asia, until we left in 1975. So they were at war some 35, 40 years, and had a negative impact on their infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
This
one
is a fire base, again 101st Airborne, and that's the South China Sea out beyond it. This was reasonably close in, so that close to the 101st Airborne base at Phu Bai, so that they used the road for resupply and did not depend on air resupply. But as you see, the soldiers, the American soldiers, were like the Montagnard soldiers right on the front lawn. Their little hooches were also the same as bunkers. And that's where they fought from, on attack. And you can see an couple of artillery pieces back there on the right. Can you see them?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The interesting thing about the arrangement in Vietnam was it struck me as a throwback to the Middle Ages, where the good guys would live in the castles and the knights would live in the castles on top of a mountain or a high hill and wander out in the daytime and chase the bandits around the castle during the day, and then at night they go back in the shelter and protection of the castle, and the bandits took over the countryside, harassing and robbing and pillaging. The same thing went on in Vietnam. We'd send out patrols during the day, and they'd look for the enemy, and if contacting them, fight them and call in artillery fire or mortar fire in support. But at night, most of the patrols would come back into this little fortified area to spend the night. Now, the long-range patrols were something else. They would go out and into the jungle area and stay for 10 days, a 10-day patrol. I'll show you. The 10-day patrollers and the long-range patrol people, I was told their longevity on patrol was 20 days. So 10 days was gave them a chance for survival. And they come back and get rested and refitted and go out again. But it was a very dangerous operation because they would be out without resupply support, wandering in a small group of anywhere from 5 to 8 people generally, looking for the enemy. And when they would identify where they were, they could then radio back, and the long-range artillery on the fire base could then zero in and hit the enemy concentration, let's say a Viet Cong supply dump or a Viet Cong training camp. When the long-range patrol would find that, they wouldn't necessarily take them on, but rather they would fall back a bit so that they weren't subject to precipitating hand-to-hand, and then call in air and artillery.
Now, the long-range patrollers staying out that long, it would seem that at times they might need the assistance of certain pharmaceuticals, amphetamines. Was that a policy?
The medic carried them with them, mm-hmm. whatever they needed. Okay. If they had wounded, they could then call in, and a dust off would go zooming out there to try to scoop them up.
Mm-hmm.
I'll show you how that worked. This is the same fire base.
Slide 22.
And you see the little bunker huts. And that highway down below, that's highway number 1, ran from Saigon to Hanoi. And Robert Falls, whom you perhaps are familiar with, he is a French historian. As a teenager, he was with the French underground World War II. After the war, he came to the United States and majored in history at Howard University and got a PhD in current history at Howard. And his dissertation, the research, was in Vietnam. He went to Vietnam. He was a Frenchman. And was with the French forces when they were fighting the Viet Minh. And because the French didn't have the air capabilities we had, they moved largely on the ground. So they were very subject to the Viet Minh ambushing them on their roadways and shooting them up in their convoys. And that's why he called this the only north to south highway, he called it the Street Without Joy, because of the large number of casualties incurred by the French on that road. He went back to Vietnam after he got his PhD and was back there with the Marines in the, sometime in the late 60s. And while he was with them, he happened to step on the landmine and was killed. His name is Robert Falls. His book, Street Without Joy, is worth reading.
Mm-hmm. Slide 23.
This is a patrol from the 101st Airborne. taking a break at the height of heat of the day. They'll patrol for a day and then get back into the fortress fire base at night. But you notice here they have tarpaulin up in there for shade, and they're standing around, and one would think, gee, isn't this a neat setup for the Viet Cong NVA to hit them? And it is. But the secret of being able to do this was in the children. If little children, 10, 12, 13 years old, were out with their trinkets to sell and their styrofoam carrying case full of ice and Coca-Cola, were out to sell Coca-Cola to the soldiers for 50 cents a can. If the kids were there, the odds were very good that they would not be assaulted. If kids didn't show up, then you didn't set up this kind of an arrangement. You settled into the tree line and made yourself as invisible as possible as you took your rest break. Because when the little children weren't around, then it was a signal that the enemy might hit you. And the reason for that is the children knew the enemy. And the children knew what the enemy was going to do, whether they were going to attack you or not that day. And if the children knew that you were going to be attacked, they didn't go out there with you. This is why the war was very strange to Americans. The children lived in the little hamlets, and the Viet Cong would circulate through the hamlets collecting supplies and war taxes, and had their adherents in the community, so that the little hamlets and the people, most of the people in the hamlets, including the children, knew what the Viet Cong and NVA were going to do. Mm-hmm. The parents would say, "Now you don't go out selling your Coca-Cola to the soldiers today, tomorrow, because it won't be safe." So the children were a good barometer, and the children were out here selling coal. Now this purple smoke, I had asked to be pulled back because I had accomplished what I had wanted to with these interviewing these soldiers. I had come out with them, and they came to get me with the helicopter, and to let them know where we were, I had them pop smoke, and then they knew, well, that's where they were, and they came and picked me up.
What kinds of questions would you ask them when you went to interview them?
What their attitude was toward air ambulances.
Mm-hmm.
They were the user group, the client group.
Mm-hmm.
They were the population. So you'd ask them, well, how good is your health care?
Mm-hmm.
Your medical coverage. Specifically, how good is your air ambulance coverage? And most of them thought pretty highly of the medical care they were getting,
mm-hmm.
From their enlisted medics and all the way.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them who had been sick or wounded and had been lifted out by air ambulance could speak personally of that experience,
mm-hmm.
And it was almost invariably positive. We pick them up so fast that they didn't even have dressings on their wounds.
Mm-hmm.
From the time they were hit until they were being offloaded at a hospital would run an average of 20 minutes. Not, I shouldn't say an average, but as little as 20 minutes.
Wow.
Guy would be hit. The medic would have their commo person call. The radio telephone operators, RTO, dust off. They got a wounded, come and get him. By the time we got there and got him to the hospital, it would be 20 minutes, as little as 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
More often, longer than that, to go out and back. Dust off worked quite close. Now, this is a fire base. And a fire base is different than a Special Forces A detachment camp. In the A detachment camp, you saw it was right up on a flat plain deep in enemy territory. The fire bases were up on top of hills. And this is Fire Base Bastogne, 101st Airborne. That black pad over there on the left is a helipad. And you see the little round pits. Those are mortar pits. It's a little hard to see everything else, but this is an old fire base that's been used for several years.
Mm-hmm.
You see how it's been defoliated all around? It was with Agent Orange, and generally Agent Orange. Special Forces camps, they denuded the vegetation right down to the ground. Go out and chop it down, bulldoze it down. Fire bases, they were up high on a knoll, and they simply would get rid of the leaves so that they could see enough in the among the tree stumps and tree trunks if they were being to defend themselves. And then they had horrendous firepower compared to a Special Forces detachment. These bases would have 80-inch howitzers, 175-millimeter long-range cannon, 105-millimeter howitzers, 150-millimeter howitzers, 80-millimeter, the big mortar, I think it's an 80-millimeter mortar. They would throw shells out 20, 25 miles. So that when they were told there was a Vietnam camp at such and such a quadrant, and it was like from here to Hale Center, they could shell it. Wouldn't even need to call in air.
Slide 25.
This is from Fire Base Vogel, one of the newer fire bases that was just operating a year or two when I was there. They took the top of a mountain and flattened it off and really built an elaborate fire base. They could have stayed there for years. And they figured they might have to. That's Agent Orange, the work of Agent Orange out there. All the trees have been defoliated.
Would they do this themselves, or would they have aircraft come in and fly defoliation missions?
Aircraft.
The C-23.
Mm-hmm.
And the slopes were chopped down.
Slide 26.
And here are the howitzers on top of Fire Base Vogel. And because the enemy did not have much in the way of aviation air interdiction capability, we could set them up like this. if they had any kind of an Air Force that came down to give us a bad time, this would be very dangerous, because all they'd have to do is put a few rounds in a, or a bomb or two on that fire base, and all of these shells would go off. It would be a holocaust. Caught that one back there in recoil. These are 150 millimeter guns. Since we had complete control of the air, it was an entirely different war than we would expect to fight against China or Russia or any other country with an air force. Now, the North Vietnamese had an air force, but they used it north of the DMZ in order to interdict our bombers that were bombing North Vietnam.
Slide 27.
Now here's a young fellow, a long range patrol guy. This is dusk. And behind him on the left is an 8-inch self-propelled howitzer. Very accurate. Could throw a shell heck of a distance. And over on the right is a 175 millimeter cannon, self-propelled. That could throw a shell way out, like 20 to 25 miles. Problem was that toward the end of that long range, it got a bit inaccurate. So if you really want to lay it on accurately, and it was within the range of the 8-inch howitzer, that was the one. Or the 150 or the 105, but the 175 would get it way out there, but we weren't always sure how close to target it was going to hit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this kid was getting ready to go as soon as it was dark on a 10-day patrol, a LRP, long-range patrol. Now, he acted like he was maybe 18, 19.
Slide 28.
And this is, again, on Firebase Vogel on the top, and that medical officer. This is 101st Airborne Base. He's now practicing obstetrics and gynecology in Houston. But at that time, he was just out of internship as a general medical officer. And this was his dispensary, first aid station. And the walls are made out of the wooden cases in which artillery rounds are shipped. And they used them as one would use, what do they call these new toys? They lock together, build off like Tinker Toys or Legos.
Okay.
Now he wasn't all that busy, because if he took care of mostly sick and non-serious wounds, because if one of their patrols was out and they got injured, like a shot, and the person seriously, like in the abdomen or chest or leg where they were not ambulatory, they wouldn't haul them back to this guy. They'd call air ambulance. Air ambulance would go out there, pick them up, overfly, not stop here, just overfly right on to the hospital that had the definitive capabilities to take care of the person.
Okay. Slide 29.
Here is a pickup with a Korean assault, on a Korean assault. And you notice this is not a place to land. It's a 45-degree slope, practically. Well, what the pilot does is fix on one of those tall reeds out there, and the crew chief tells the pilot where the rotor is and where the skid is on the near side of the aircraft. The skid on the right side is about some 6 to 8 feet off the ground, and the skid on the left side is just about touching the ground, and the rotor is missing the ground by about 10 inches up at the top of its stroke. And this is a little rice paddy that Viet Cong would have, rice that would grow on dry land. So, you know, you couldn't grow rice on dry land. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have it in a pond.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping to get the rotor as it went by, but obviously I didn't. But it was about 10 inches off the ground.
Wow.
Now the problem with this is when you load a patient onto it, it changes the weight of the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the crew chief, and the aircraft, by the way, belongs to the crew chief, not the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
The pilots and the medics don't know which aircraft they're going to be flying in one day to the next. The crew chief stays with that aircraft all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And is responsible for its first and second echelon maintenance. Well, so he tells the pilot what the situation is. Mm-hmm. Here comes the Korean being carried fireman's fashion. By the way, we hardly ever use litters, because in the jungle, a litter is a kind of a clumsy thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought him up and they eased him onto the aircraft, and crew chief would say, okay, we're gonna take him aboard, get ready to add power. And okay, he's on board, and as the aircraft pilot would be aware that he was sinking a little bit, he'd juice up the... They're remarkable, you know, it's just... Talk about fine-tuning.
Mm-hmm.
My gosh.
32?
This is what the jungle looked like from up above. And it was not unusual for, if enemy were up on the ridge, to literally shoot down at an air ambulance, helicopter, or a slick or whatever. The helicopters would go this way.
33?
Got a call out, and the Koreans were fighting the enemy, and it was, the firefight was hot enough so that they couldn't move the person to a clearing. They were essentially pinned down, virtually pinned down. So we went out and got over the area and asked them to pop smoke. And then we'd tell them the color, and they'd say yes. Then we knew it, because they learned early on that if they'd say, okay, here we are, pop yellow smoke so we'll know where you are, two or three pods of yellow smoke would appear.
Mm-hmm.
Because the enemy was monitoring the radio frequency, and he says, pop yellow smoke, give me the...
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a choice. And if you picked the wrong choice, you were dead meat. So this worked a little better. They'd pop the smoke, and then we'd tell them, or finish up here.
34?
You see how dusty it is up there? That's the rotor cutting the trees. We settle down into the canopy like a quail into weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a relatively new crew chief on this one. And he said to the pilot, you're in the trees, the rotors are hitting the trees. And the pilot, very nonchalant, he said, I know that. Just tell me how big around they are. And the reason is that if they're an inch or less, the rotor can cut them off.
Yeah.
If they're more than an inch, they'll break the rotor.
Yeah.
And if they break the rotor, you go down. You're all through for the day. So you literally settle right down and you see the little twigs flying around and settling.
Slide 35.
And here we are hovering over it. This is that same group with the purple smoke. That was,
mm-hmm.
And there they are, see them down there, those little figures?
Mm-hmm.
And we're throwing up some dust. This is fairly good because there are trees that are down. And if you're going to put in troops, you could go close enough with a small helicopter like a Huey to within 10 feet of the ground, and the soldiers could jump off the skid. But so this was, most of the time we couldn't see people on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a good one, even though we had to use the jungle penetrator.
Slide 36.
And here they are. Again. See, we've settled down as close as we can into the jungle itself. So we're below the treetops. Treetops are all around us. So that for the enemy to, even though there's a firefight going on right down there in the jungle, for the enemy to hit us, this is quite difficult because they can hear the rotor pop, 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 but they can't really see us or get a good shot at us.
Slide 7.
And I'll stop at this point.
Okay.
The black fellow is a medic, and this is one of his early flights with us. He's newly assigned with this group. And this is with the 498th, not the 101st. And this guy here, name on his helmet is Fagan.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Korean. He was a Korean orphan. And a American Air Force sergeant stationed in Korea adopted him when he was age 9. And as he and his wife wanted children,
mm-hmm.
apparently they could handle another child if they didn't have any. I don't know how many they had, but they decided they could take care of a Korean orphan. So they adopted him, brought him back to the States at age 9. So he went through all of his education through high school and U.S. school and had their name, Fagan,
mm-hmm.
and spoke excellent English. Well, he wasn't part of a flight crew. He was a corporal who was a supply soldier in our supply. But whenever the unit would go out to cover the Koreans, combat assaults, he would volunteer to go along. And he wasn't getting any extra flight pay or combat pay, but he would fly all day, every flight, cover the Koreans. And the colonel of the regiment, who was apparently new, was talking to Mayor, Henry Mayer and me, and he said, it's really great that you have a soldier who can speak Korean. He said, but do you know, he only has the vocabulary of a 9-year-old. When we told him why,
mm-hmm.
he was quite impressed. Hogan had all 3 or 4 decorations from the Koreans for what he had done.
Well,
and to my knowledge, he had not a single decoration from the Americans for what he had done. That's the way life is sometimes.
Yep.
It ain't necessarily fair.
No.
Let's.
All right, we're back from a break for lunch. And continuing with Dr. Bessler.
Okay, we talked about this one.
Mm-hmm. Slide 38.
Here's coming in, a Korean coming in on the hoist.
Very nice.
And here is Fagan, taking the carotid pulse of a wounded Korean. You notice no litters on the floor. We'd have as many as 6 to 8 on the floor at a time. And in order to take the pulse of one, you have to travel down the arm to be sure it was attached to the patient you were interested in. It might belong to, because it was like a can of worms.
Right.
But there was no way to make, to utilize litters effectively. They take up too much of them. Here we could move all around in there but among these, but if you have the litters running crossways, it's like a room divider. Well, this fellow was shot in the left eye with an AK-47. The black kid is a medic, which you saw before. And there's Fagan with no medical training, just what he had learned by his frequent excursions for days and weeks at a time, that he was a very good self-taught medic, very conscientious. And this medic, the African-American, is actually learning from him because the African-American is rather new to him.
The man who's wounded, you say he was shot in the eye by an
AK-47? Yeah. He was also shot in the groin.
Right.
And that little dot about the size of an eraser head, you see it down the groin?
Mm-hmm.
It's the entrance wound of an AK-47.
Did it go all the way through?
All the way through and out the back.
Right.
They're hard to. It's not all that easy when you evaluate a person. You can, in a hurry, under stress situation, a lot of confusion, you can overlook where in the hell the entry wound was. Because that's all it is. Looks like a little black mole.
Mm-hmm. This is slide 40. Now, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of blood loss at the entry wound.
No. Bleeds on the way out.
Slide 41.
On that case, Fagan, the guy, the head, shot in the eye, who was in the head, so he had a head wound, and he kept periodically dying, stopping. Fagan, right in the helicopter, did CPR. And when they offloaded him, he ran alongside the gurney, giving CPR as they wheeled him into the Korean Division Hospital, right into the operating room. And they got him on the table, but he didn't make it. But that was kind of giving you an idea of the behavior of Fagan. These were, ancestrally, these are his people.
Mm-hmm.
This is an area we'd offload about where we're standing, the helipad. And this is where the wounded were first moved in. And generally, with an assault going on, you'd have anywhere from 1 to 4 or 5 helicopter trips or loads, anywhere from 2 or 3 up to 20, 25 wounded all at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a big cleared room except with places to put the letter, and I'll show you how it is. Here's an example, Quonset. This is 27th Surgical Hospital. You see the homemade wooden horses in the litter on one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the bar across the ceiling there with stethoscopes and bottles of fluid hanging on. Well, we bring them in here and they just put up the litters and the whole side there would be wounded one after another, like 8-10, and the triage people would be in there evaluating the nature of the wounds and had all their supplies there on the side and do the sorting and right down the hall where the figure is in the doorway would be x-ray and surgery. Zip, zip, zip.
This is slide 42. Sir, the triage process, as you witnessed it, could you describe it in terms of how they prioritized the most severely wounded that didn't look like they'd make it? I mean, in the civilian world, the priority is always the most severely wounded person. Is that the case? Was that the case there?
The principle of triage in mass casualty is you take those, treat those who can be saved, but need immediate attention.
Mm-hmm.
And you set those aside who in all likelihood aren't going to make it anyway. And you set those aside that can wait.
Mm-hmm.
Here, the mass casualty situation was never that gross.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you weren't dealing with a half of a community that had been nuked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They could handle 20, 25 people in here pretty decently.
Mm-hmm.
If they were minimally wounded or like walking wounded, they would depending on how busy their personnel were and what specialty areas, they would either get delayed treatment or get treatment immediately, depending on availability of personnel, because
mm-hmm.
a lot of that stuff could be taken care of by a general medical officer.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it's a head injury. You had three head injuries here. You had one neurosurgeon. Then he'd have to decide which one he needed to take first that he had a reasonable chance to save, and if he delayed it, would die. And if another one, like that Korean shot in the left eye, and the bullet went through his head and came out here, and he was going in and out of respiratory arrest, you'd make him comfortable, period. Because he was a lost soul anyway. But where you had several physicians who could do the job and had a greater opportunity to take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, if you had minor injuries, minor ones, the pediatricians could be brought in
mm-hmm.
and take care of it.
Right.
And the interns, so.
Slide 43.
This is fire-based roof court. You perhaps have read and heard about it.
Yes, sir.
The 101st Airborne had a couple platoons, they may have had a full company at one time, but generally it was less than the company strength on that fire base. And this was out quite far and was resupplied by air. The only little trickling road there is almost a walking path. So this one was resupplied by air helicopter. Well, they were attacked by a reinforced North Vietnamese regular army regiment consisting of probably at least 5,000 to 6,000 first line soldiers. And they attacked that group of 100, 150 guys for 6 weeks continuously. And these guys held out. Well, it was a stalemate, and neither side was getting anywhere. So, discretion being the better part of valor, do we sit here and show the NVA we can take it, or do we say enough of this attrition? Well, let's get the hell out of here. So they decided that.
Mm-hmm.
And I arrived at the time that evacuation was taken, as I arrived with the 101st. So I rotated all over South Vietnam. They were evacuating, and they took them about a week. They destroyed the artillery pieces in place, got the heavy weapons, machine guns, and the personnel off. Anything else was destroyed in place. It took them a week to get them up because fighting was going on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
In that week, they lost, 101st lost 17 helicopters in the evacuation process. How many were empty and how many had troops that they were in the process of evacuating, I don't know. But 6 out of the 17 were air ambulances of those shot down. How many air crews do you think they rescued? This is in South Vietnam. One out of the 17. One air crew was rescued. 16 air crews never heard from again. Now, you know, the probability is reasonably high that there must have been one or two people alive out of those 16 helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't all go down in flames. Some of them just were disabled and crashed by auto rotation. But that was one of the interesting battles.
Slide 44.
This is about a month after that. It was decided that they now had the North Vietnamese regiment was in such a position either for retraining and reorganizing, but they were in a situation where it seemed appropriate to hit them. So this is a counterattack about a month after Ripcord was evacuated. And I was in the line of helicopters that haul these people in. The first airplane that came in was a C-130. It had a 1,000-pound bomb with a long probe in the nose. And they rolled it off the ramp. We went down, and the probe hit the ground, and the bomb exploded about height of the ceiling. So it didn't dig a hole. The purpose was for it to be a lawn cutter, a lawnmower, and it blew the trees off. So the stumps were anywhere from a couple of feet to 3, 4, 5 feet high. But the helicopters that followed the C-130 could then come in and go down and hover above the ground 5 to 10 feet, and the Vietnamese Arvin soldiers would jump off. And the advantage of air assault is that you don't put them on the ground 10 miles from the enemy. You put them on the ground as close to the enemy as you can get them, with the distance being just sufficient for them to offload and get organized, and they didn't have to march half the day to get to the enemy, but rather just a few hundred meters. Well, this is a whole string of Hueys full of these guys. And at the very tail end was air ambulance. I happened to be riding it. And we were at the end of this string. The helicopters didn't go inside, but it was a string. One would go in it, offload, and the other one would be approaching off. You know, very well organized. And by the time the last helicopter had unloaded and flown out, we flew in to pick up the first of the wounded, because the soldiers who had gotten off early on had gone, faced the enemy, and some of them were wounded and were being hauled back to this clearing, and we fished them out. After that many years in this kind of warfare, some of the operations were really just like clockwork, mm-hmm. really efficient. Well,
slide 45.
This is Cam Duc, 2 kilometers from the Laotian border. Big airstrip built by the French and improved by the Americans. And if you look way down there, you see a notch in the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a straight ridge line. The French cut a notch in there so that aircraft could come in to land without going up over the hump and then coming down. They could fly through the notch like a little pass. And if you look closely, you can see the wings of an airplane in there. That's a C-130 coming in to land on the strip. And this aircraft sitting down here is an air ambulance. The air ambulance was the first to land and the first to stay on the ground in this combat assault. Now, this was one of the 10 biggest combat assaults conducted in our 20 years in Vietnam. Not one word was written in the American press. It didn't exist. Reporters sat around the hotels in Saigon. The only reporter we had with us was an ex-AmeriCal soldier who came back as a freelance journalist and stopped off to visit his buddies. And they said, hey, we're going on a big combat assault. Want to come along? So he went over to the general, and the general said, yeah, come along. You're the only reporter who's been interested. The rest were down in Saigon waiting for the paper handouts. This guy came in on the assault with us and was a freelancer, and as far as I know, I never ever heard of anything being published, but it was huge. It was more than division and strength. We had total probably 25,000 soldiers. Arvin were in it, AmeriCal division was in it, a whole battalion of aviation. We had gotten word that there were 2,000 or more NVA using this airstrip as a base, resupply base, with NVA aircraft coming in to resupply them. So the decision was, well, we can, that's great. We got 2,000 all in one place. We'll swoop in and really do them some damage. But first we have to tell the Vietnamese government that we're going to do it. The end result was they just walked back two kilometers into Laos and left a rear guard. So we were harassed by a rear guard, but probably not more than a company of their troops, 150, 200 soldiers, where we were really looking for 2,000. But they were in the hills around us. Finish the sequence.
This is slide 46.
This is a little pond right near the runway, on one side of the runway. Really kind of like a Playa Lake here, you know, although it doesn't look like anything. But the Army engineers, U.S. engineers, zipped in there, set this up in reverse osmosis. We had fresh water almost immediately.
47.
And this is the old Special Forces camp that had come into the area in the middle 60s to occupy it. And they were driven out during the Tet Offensive, and that's the debris that was left when they were shot up and pulled out.
49 or 48.
And these are holes from 1,000-pound bombs. And you can see the size of the people, little black dots. Those are really big holes. And that clay was as hard as cement. The advantage of the bombs is we build our underground shelters in the shell hole. Didn't have to dig for it. You just go and dig it, build it at the bottom.
49.
And here is, we're standing on the runway watching a firefight up on the top. It's a fire base up above. And the Viet Cong NVAs were shooting down at us from there. So we sent assault troops up the ridge from this side up to drive them off, and they were driven down into the tree line on that side of the ridge. and you see the two dots, the one dot in the cloud and the one dot just above the tree line.
Mm-hmm.
Those are Arvin, South Vietnamese aircraft. They hit what we used out here at Reese, the T-37, a Cessna side-by-side jet trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And they used them for close air support. And that one that's over the tree line had come across the ridge, just shaving the ridge, and took off. And as he shaved the ridge, he let go his napalm, and it went tumbling down and didn't have fins, so it just tumbled. Here's the ridge, it kept tumbling. And as it fell like that. So, and just followed the curve of the hill. It was remarkable. The way he timed it, dropped it down, and landed right there in the tree line,
mm-hmm.
right where the Viet Cong were. And the guy behind him and the cloud is going to follow him through. When they were through dumping their stuff, they flew around, came down, went down the runway, and did a victory roll. These guys had about 2,000 hours of combat flying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a whole career for an American Air Force person.
Mm-hmm.
They wore black satin flight suits with white scarves. They were just like drugstore cowboys. They strut in their dark glasses, but they were damn good.
Mm-hmm. Slide 50.
And there is the fire base that was recaptured, and we were flying in to pick up a wounded person from that fighting. But that aircraft had come in this angle and hit the Viet Cong in the other end. As you see the jungle, it's hilly and all jungle. This is 2 miles from Laos. This is debris from the time the special forces were driven out. See the front end loader with the scoop full of dirt. They didn't even have time to dump the dirt. They scooped it up and then the word was, get the hell out of here. And they left it right there. And see, the tires are no longer on the machine. Went up and looked, and you could see where they had cut it out for sandals. And this is part of a CH-47 rotor, helicopter rotor. And there's a C-130 from that same Tet period, four-engine aircraft that was destroyed.
Slide 53.
And this is from the French at Cam Duc. Eisenhower had given them a bunch of C-119s, transport, twin boom aircraft, flying boxcar, they called it. Put here, kind of reminded you how long the wars had been going on, because here a little tree is growing up out through the windows. That where it had been pushed off the edge of the runway. And here is a mortar crew just sending out harassing fire as the rear guard were scattered around in the hills sniping at us. And this was just to keep them a little off balance. Probably didn't do much good. And here's a Jolly Green Giant bringing in a load. We were there for about 2 months, all told. This is the size of the load the guy's sitting on.
56.
And here is a medic digging in that sad-looking guy without a hat. He's a pediatrician. He had about 2 months to go. He had done his entire duty in one of the hospitals as a pediatrician along the coast of the South China Sea, real, stateside type duty, air conditioned hoot, all the deal. And his commander came in and said, they need a battalion surgeon, and you're it. And He was as sad as he looked when he saw me and saw that I was a medic, a colonel. I came up to him and I said, "How are you doing?" All he said was, "Why me? Why me?" Then he told me his story. I only had 2 months to go, and they put me in. I'm a pediatrician from New York. And I said, "Ease up. You're not going to get hurt. This will give you something to tell your children about." It didn't seem to satisfy me. He really felt that he had been discriminated against, I guess. Digging a hole in the ground there was very hard work. This is me, and the guy in the door is a black medic, a hell of a nice guy, very bright. Two people were up on the roof working on the rotor. 3 weeks from the time this picture was taken, everybody in the picture was dead except me. The black guy volunteered to take the place of another medic who was supposed to go out on the sortie and was sick, so he volunteered to fill in. That's when he was killed. And the other two were killed at approximately the same time. But where, I don't know, but they were all killed.
58.
And this is, you're getting a little deeper in the ground here. The hole's bigger. Everybody had to dig their own foxholes, including myself. Nobody came around and said, "Just because you're an old man, we'll dig it for you." We had to defend our own foxholes so that they were all arranged perimeter, so they faced outward, so that if attacked at night, you could, right from your foxhole, fire toward the periphery.
59.
And this is a completed aid station with sandbags, and the air ambulance sitting there, stayed there day and night. And they're really, that constitutes an awful lot of work piled up.
60.
And this is Ann's son in the background. And this guy was coming home late at night from Quinyon to Ann's, to Lane Heliport. And he passed by Anson, and the Viet Cong must have been in there collecting taxes at night. And one of them opened up with a machine gun, shot him down. And that's where our careless lads would go for prostitution services.
Did anybody survive?
I don't know. I just passed over and didn't look back.
Um, 61.
I guess we'll stop here.
Okay.
That's the 27th Surgical Hospital with a helicopter sitting on a pad. And you see the amphitheater?
Mm-hmm.
It's the Bob Hope Amphitheater.
Okay.
Bob Hope, as you know, every year would, when he was younger more often, go to entertain the troops. But he had, because he, who he was and all, he wanted it to be made worth his while. "I'm going to come over here. I don't want to just put on this gala performance for a couple hundred soldiers." So his request was that they have at least 2,500 soldiers or more.
Mm-hmm.
"If you want me to put on a show, I want 2,500 or more." Martha Ray, whom you may have meeting with the Big Mom, she was a reserve Lieutenant Colonel in the Nurse Corps, served in World War II. And she would come over and insist on going to small units. and she'd go solo, put on a solo stand. And she was in a special, she had a particular attachment to the Special Forces camps. And they flew her out on this occasion to one of them way out in the boonies. And while she was there, the NBA Viet Cong attack, and it looked like they were obviously trying to overrun the camp. And her escort said, "Well, Miss Ray, we can get out of here if we leave right away. We can still get out on the helicopter." And she said, "No, I'm not just a comedian. I'm a nurse, and I'm going to stay here and help take care of any of this wounded." And she stayed through the whole damn firefight, assisting the enlisted medic, taking care of what wounded came in. Of course, the American medics took care of the Montagnard wounded, mm-hmm. and took care of all of them. So she was probably not just standing there twiddling her thumbs. It was reasonably busy. And then they took her out. But she had done, that's one instance. And since she would go out to the Special Forces camp over several visits to Vietnam, they adopted her and made her an honorary mm-hmm. member of Special Forces. At a conference I was at four or five years ago, I was standing at the bar, Special Forces conference, standing at the bar. And I turned and looked toward the entrance to the hotel, and in came Martha Ray. And there was no one there to greet her. And so I left my bar stool and went over and introduced myself and said, "Welcome." And just a little thing, she reached up, kissed me on the cheek, and whispered in my ear, "Where in the hell is the ladies' room?" So I'll leave it at that.
Okay, we'll stop. This will stop the interview on the 26th of January. Thank you, Dr. Bachelor. This is Steve Maxter, continuing the interview with Dr. John Bessler on the 26th of January at approximately 3:45 in the afternoon. Okay, sir, I guess we should pick up with slide number 62.
Okay.
As we already discussed the...
those buildings in the background.
Mm-hmm.
That's the base camp for the AmeriCal Division.
Okay.
Which I think was the 23rd Infantry Division. They generally call it the AmeriCal Division.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same one that was involved, one of its companies in the My Lai massacre.
Yes, sir.
It's a big division, and it sent a battalion with us on the Can Duck raid, mm-hmm. Can Duck operation. They had about 1,000, contributed about 1,000, 1,500, and the Arvin contributed a couple battalions and a whole Army aviation battalion. So that's their home base.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is 62.
And this is the 173rd Airborne Brigade. One of its aid stations, and you notice it's partially underground
mm-hmm.
with the dirt piled up at the side. And the entrance is a right angle, like a Z. You go in and you turn left and then you turn right. So if somebody throws a grenade in or some such rocket, it only explodes in the entrance, not in the main body.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And
this is the interior of that, partially underground. And again, the comparison in size, you see the medic there with his shirt off,
uh-huh.
standing next to, across a litter from a, this is Vietnamese, not Montagnard,
mm-hmm.
Woman. And a father sitting here, and the reason there are kids on the litter, three of them, The Viet Cong wasn't happy with the fact that the villagers were friendly to the GIs a nearby village, and wanted them to participate more in espionage and petty sabotage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently they didn't get the same positive response that they wanted. So like in Chicago or New York, where they're practicing extortion, if you want to keep your store from blowing up, you're going to have to pay us. So the extortion here was not so much in money, because they collected the Viet Cong war taxes anyway. They came in during recess while the local schools and kids were in the play yard, and they threw a hand grenade at the Viet Cong. And that's very persuasive. And those are the kids that were injured by the hand grenade. And the parents, of course, are being taught a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the only place they could take them for immediate care was to the American outfit.
Slide 64.
We were flying along one Sunday afternoon, no particular mission, and we saw a column of Arvin half tracks and trucks going along a road of convoy. And while we watched, looking down the hillside on their left, broke open with a lot of small arms fire. And we just happened to be sitting there on top of them when they were ambushed. And they immediately came to a halt, and their people jumped out and jumped in the ditches and so on. Well, we circled around and came in low, expecting that they were probably getting some wounded. And here they have tossed a smoke grenade to show us where they're taking their wounded. And there's one of them being dragged along right there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a armored personnel carrier,
mm-hmm.
in which they brought the wounded from the road to this little bare spot where we sat down, and we scooped them up and took them to the Province Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Just by chance, we happened to be right there at the moment they were hit.
Mm-hmm. 66.
This is where the Air Force came into the medevac picture.
Mm-hmm.
They transported, they were not charged with transporting people within the theater. This air ambulance is a C-141, big four-engine
mm-hmm.
jet. And it's at Camran Bay, where they had a large collecting hospital. The rule was, if you could patch up a person so they could be back to duty in 10 days or less, you could keep them in the theater,
mm-hmm.
treat them in. And if your estimate was that they were going to take more than 10 days, or if they took more than 10 days, then you had to move them out of the theater.
Mm-hmm.
So you transported them down to Cameron Bay and collected them and loaded them on one of these. And this one went to Japan.
67.
And this is at a U.S. Air Force base in Japan, in Tokyo. And they've just gotten off the 147 and are being pushed over on homemade gurneys to a helicopter. And the reason they go to the helicopter is because to transport them on the ground in Tokyo, in those days the roads were narrow and very congested. took 8 hours from the Air Force base to the Army hospital. 8 hours. Stop, go, stop, go. Took 20 minutes for the helicopter. So we'd overfly Tokyo to the hospital. And this is one of the hospitals.
68.
There were two. One was Camp Zama and the other was Camp Drake.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Japanese office building that was turned over to the Americans, which the Americans rented and renovated into a hospital. You see the two flags.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fairly decent facility.
Mm-hmm. How long was the flight from Vietnam to Japan? Do you recall?
What do you think? Oh, I can't. I think it was close to 2.5 hours,
okay.
Plus or minus.
Okay.
2.5, 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. 69.
The Marines had their own system of aero medevac.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned before, the two others were the 101st and the Air Cab that had their own organic platoon, air
mm-hmm.
ambulance platoon that only took care of their own people. And then the medical battalion system, which took care of the whole countryside, anything that happened.
Mm-hmm.
They were called, they went. Well, the Marines had their own, and they took care of only their own.
Mm-hmm.
But they did not use dedicated crews or dedicated aircraft. They would, a crew would get air ambulance duty by reading the duty roster when it was posted, and they'd find, oh, geez, next week I'm going to be flying air ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
And the same crew, crew chief, two pilots, two machine gunners. They had 50 caliber machine guns that they used on the front of their baby Chinooks. And they'd add a Navy medic would be added to the crew when they were going to be dust off. These are the famous Marble Mountains
mm-hmm.
at Da Nang. Riddled with caves because they were literally marble quarries. And the Marines, when they first landed, took them quite a while, several months of pretty close-in fighting to rout the Viet Cong out of those mountains. And that's the South China Sea over on the side, and that, see the beach, the Long Beach? It's the famous Red Beach. There was a television program a couple of years back. They called it China Beach,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Red Beach in reality, but Hollywoodized. Okay.
Slide
70. This is what the Marines used. That was their helicopter. They had no Hueys.
Mm-hmm.
They only used this, period. C-40. Six. A mini Chinook looked similar to the Army CH-47,
mm-hmm.
which was about a third as long, third longer, and the bulge on the side ran the whole length of the CH-47, which is where they carried the fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So this is smaller, but similar configuration, twin rotor.
Mm-hmm.
They called it a baby Chinook. Army didn't think much of them, but the Marines seemed to like them.
Mm-hmm. 71.
This is the interior. 250 calibers up in the front door, two pilots, crew chief, and they'd add a Navy medic.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd carry their wounded out on this thing. Now, they did not like to go in alone. Army would send in its air ambulances solo 90%+ of the time
mm-hmm.
with no gunship support or anything else. We just duck in and duck out.
Mm-hmm.
But the Marines, maybe it's because their aircraft is more cumbersome, or their technique, I have no idea. But they hated this duty because they were more likely to be shot down flying aeromedevac
mm-hmm.
than anything else. So when this is the aeromed ship assigned to the aeromedevac in, out on a mission
mm-hmm.
inside of it. And out through the back is the chase ship. See it?
Mm-hmm.
If this one gets shot up on the ground, that one zips in and tries to rescue what's left.
Okay.
So on every call, they tied up two aircraft.
Yeah.
One to land and the other to hang up there as a rescue aircraft.
This is slide 72. I was curious about the Marine Corps employment of that second ship. Do you think it was because the Army using the Huey, a faster, more maneuverable helicopter, and that mini Chinook, probably not as easy to get in quickly and get out quickly?
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
And this is 73?
And their aeromedevac crews didn't fly that mission all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, they didn't use hoists. I never did see a hoist.
Yeah.
So they have to go on land.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Marines would have to draw their wounded back to a clearing, all of which made them more vulnerable.
Yes.
This is a collecting company, Marine, for the 1st Marine Division.
Mm-hmm.
Or the 3rd Marine Division was the one I was with over there. It's mostly underground. And as you see, it looks like a triage station, which is what it really is. And here's where they get their wounded from that CH-47 that flies in. And,
mm-hmm.
and they triage them and give them life support. And then they have to transport them to a hospital. Well, they don't use Army hospitals. They use Navy hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
Navy hospitals are in ships,
mm-hmm.
not on land. And their CH-46s were too big to land on the fantail of the sanctuary,
mm-hmm.
which is a hospital ship.
Mm-hmm.
See that flat platform at the back?
Yes, sir.
CH-47 could land there nicely, and these things sat out in the harbor to avoid sneak attacks and terrorism. But here's one coming in. Army would then pick up the Marine wounded at the Marine collecting station.
Mm-hmm.
When they had a bunch of them, they'd say, come in and haul them out to sanctuary, and we'd do that and unload them here and
mm-hmm.
turn them over.
Slide 75. This is 76.
This is a German hospital ship.
Mm-hmm.
They had no combat forces in Vietnam. They only provided this hospital ship as humanitarian aid. And it was docked. This was at Da Nang, and it would go right in and dock on the port. We wouldn't do that because VC might come running up with a satchel charge
mm-hmm.
and blow a hole in the boat. But whenever the German hospital ship was in the harbor at dock, it was told to me that the town was very happy because they weren't shelled. When the German hospital ship was not at the dock, then the VC would periodically throw some mortar shells in just as part of the harassment that goes on in warfare. Because they wouldn't shell them while the hospital ship was in, because the VC used it. They'd dress up in a civilian garb and infiltrate the city and get down to the dock and go aboard the ship, and they'd get taken care of. The Germans made it their policy. They didn't ask any questions. Didn't matter who.
Mm-hmm.
If they were ill, they'd take care of them. civilians or Viet Cong. Now the Arvins and all the other forces had their own health service support hospitals. So really the hospital ship there took care of local civilians and Viet Cong and VA. Very strange. You know, and we knew it, and there was nothing we deemed appropriate to do.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't go down and stand at the gangway and ask for ID. It was their ship, and they were doing what they wanted to do.
I got it.
But again, it's one of those funny things that happen in war.
Right. Now, do you recall the name of that ship?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I was visiting an air ambulance base up near Hue,
mm-hmm.
and they got a call to go out and pick up a wounded Arvin soldier who was part of a long-range patrol. They were deep in enemy-held territory, and when I say enemy-held, it was mostly all of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
Because at night they held it, daytime they may shrink back into the brush and the hills, but the night belonged to the pretty much the enemy. Well, when you're on long range patrol and you got a wounded person, it's better they were dead than wounded, because they slow you down.
Mm-hmm.
Dead, you leave them. And the long range patrols were not interested in starting firefights and hand-to-hand combat way out there. They were out there to pick up intelligence information,
mm-hmm.
and call in other means to get after them. Or sometimes it would end up, they'd put together an assault force that would go in and actually start a fight about it. But here we're landed out there and bringing him aboard.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very happy even before this guy got in the helicopter. They were on their way, mm-hmm. scurrying away because the enemy was chasing them.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting aspect was when we were putting together the crew to go out, which took a matter of 2 minutes. The pilot, co-pilot, and the crew chief were talking to the medic, enlisted medic, and the enlisted medic said, and I happened to be standing there, and the medic said, but I'm a short timer, I only have 2 weeks to go. Do you really need me on this one? And so, remembering that I was a physician, I said, I'll go as replacement for the medic. Even though my role was participant observer ordinarily, there wasn't any reason why I couldn't go to work.
Mm-hmm.
I went, the kid with the short term, breathed a sigh of relief,
mm-hmm.
and I took his place. Nothing untoward happened. But you know, they get nervous toward the end. They figure,
mm-hmm.
they've used up the law of averages. It's going to work against them the last few days.
That was 77, and this is 78.
This is, again, the South China Sea, and at those buildings on back in the trees on the
yes
right
sir.
There
mm-hmm.
is a leprosarium run by French nuns.
Okay.
And the French nuns were there, and the French were long since gone, and the war was going on. So how do they survive? How do they take care of the lepers in a situation that's as fluid and chaotic as that? Well, we're coming in to land on the beach and go swimming. We had lunch with them, and the sister superior had us to lunch. French cuisine, really first rate.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful for food. And she took us through the leprosarium, walked down the street. There were huts and hospitals. And about a third of the buildings had looked right in the stone, brick, built courtesy of the 34th Military Police Battalion, built courtesy of the 24th Engineers. About a third of these buildings had been built by American GIs in their spare time.
Wow.
Scrounged up the material, got it hauled out there, and built them.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't just clapboard. They were brick and cement. So that's kind of impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sister Superior reminded us that we were welcome to use the beach. She said, but you remember, told the Major Mayor, don't go beyond that crop of trees down at the far end of the beach. You see where it sticks out, those trees?
Yes, sir.
Don't go down to or beyond those. And he says, yes, I remember. She said, okay, have a good time. And I asked him, why can't we go past that clump of trees? We see it when you're on the ground better. He said, do you see it down there at the edge where that faint blue-ish seeming smoke is coming from? That's an old Japanese landing barge from World War II. The Hulk was sitting there rusting. Well, it was used as a operating base and shelter by the local Viet Cong. They lived in it. And you could see their laundry hanging out, drying. And they got along with the nuns, and the nuns got along with them, and the nuns needed the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew that the nuns needed the Americans, so they worked out a deal with the nuns. They worked out a deal with the nuns that, well, if you keep your American friends at this end of the beach, it'll be okay. But if they come down that far, we're going to have to defend ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And a firefight would result. So she just reminded us, now remember, you don't go down that far. Well, while we were there, a couple of the guys thought they'd go fishing by throwing hand grenades in the water. So they threw hand grenades in the water, you know, up here where we're swimming. And after a couple of those, one of the nuns came rapidly walking toward us across the beach. The Viet Cong had contacted the Sister Superior to tell the Americans to stop throwing hand grenades in the water. That makes us nervous, and we don't like it. So the nun sent one of her sisters to come down and tell us to stop it, which we promptly did.
Mm-hmm.
I was telling him, this is the leprosarium on the right. And down at the end where you see a little very faint gray seeming like smoke, it's from a old Japanese landing craft that was rusting there from World War II. And the Viet Cong lived there. And there you could see their laundry hanging out. And we could swim at this end of this part of the beach, but we couldn't go beyond or down to that clump of trees that project out farther onto the beach. Because down that far, they told the nuns that didn't they have to shoot at us. But as long as we stayed on this side, they wouldn't bother. This worked out pretty good. in addition to building all those buildings for them that the American GIs had done, I asked the Major Mayor, gee, how did you work such a, how come you're such a welcome guest? And he said, well, Sister Superior let me know that if I could help them in any way, it would be greatly appreciated. And he asked what she needed, and she said, well, she needed a dozen or more mattresses. So he managed to, through the system, trade a souvenir to a supply sergeant. They loaded up the helicopter with mattresses. He flew them out of here, gave them to the sister so she could put new mattresses in some of her leprosarium bunks. Funny war.
79.
And this is again the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. People made, press made fun of it. Anything about Vietnam was ridiculed. The Vietnam soldiers were no good, which wasn't true. We were doing all the fighting, which wasn't true. And the climate and weather, the climate and environment was just dreadful. Well, if you think Florida is dreadful, then you think Vietnam is dreadful. Because Vietnam is a hell of a lot like Florida, I discovered.
Mm-hmm. Number 80.
And here is the last slide that does that 5th Special Forces Group quotation of Winston Churchill. I guess you can read that without my help.
All right.
Should I read it for the purposes of this?
Sure, why don't you?
Okay. The sign hanging outside of headquarters building at 5th Special Forces Group states, quotation, Winston Churchill, still, if you will not fight for the right when you can easily win without bloodshed, if you will not fight when your victory will be sure and not too costly, you may come to the moment when you will have to fight with all the odds against you and only a precarious chance of survival. There may even be a worse case. You may have to fight when there is no hope of victory, because it is better to perish than to live as a slave. Winston Churchill. That's the end of this group.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Bessler.
Thank you.